I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. My interview with Shamir Gupta continues. Shamir is the son of Indian American immigrants, beginning his musical journey firmly in the world of jazz. His fourth grade teacher in Tokyo, Japan, introduced him to Johann Sebastian Bach. According to Gupta, his musical fuse was lit.
Our teachers are always the first persons to really help to steer us in a direction creatively or otherwise. Yeah. I would take you back to your fourth grade experience and your fourth grade teacher in Japan. Would you share that story with our audience?
Sure. I mean, I definitely remember, you know, being in a music appreciation class. It's actually interestingly, I was living in Tokyo, Japan, and I was going to the American school in Japan. It's the American school kind of chain. They're all over the world. So this was the American school in Japan, which was a very strange experience because it almost felt like we weren't in Japan. You know, it was like this really, it was like a bubble where it felt like you were going to literally an American school. Everything was taught in English. Japanese was a foreign language class in the middle of the day. And so that was where I was when I had an amazingly transformative experience where I was listening to a cassette tape that a teacher had brought in. And it was Bach. It was like the Brandenburg Concertos. And, you know, I just remember hearing it and my jaw just dropping. I'd never heard anything so beautiful and clear. And so, you know, it clearly kind of with this triumphant fanfare sort of feeling. I mean, I still hear it in my ear. You know, if anyone's heard the Brandenburg Concertos with the trumpet, it's like calling, you know, it's like a call from afar. It's very beautiful. And I just remember asking that teacher if I could take that cassette home. And I just wore that cassette out. Like the ink got worn away and the cassette itself eventually just broke. And so that was really the first time where I kind of got completely hooked by music. And I kind of was able to start playing with the concert band there. And they assigned me some different instruments. Trombone was the first instrument. Was a little challenging for me to get trombone. But once I moved to the drums, the percussion and the house playing on music stands first, I picked it up very, very quickly. And I was able to kind of move forward to playing real instruments. And that kind of affirmation, I think, was just well-timed. I think I wanted to find something that I was good at that didn't feel like it was necessarily the dictated path by, you know, my immigrant parents or what was considered, you know, normal by the, you know, judgment of the Indian community or, you know, which typically like a lot of people maybe know, it's like usually a very lucrative and, you know, doctors, lawyers, very, very sort of strict on thinking that that's the way to have success. So there, you know, that began my journey in saying, I'm going to define success on my own terms. And the feeling of playing music and getting good at it and feeling how people can connect and be inspired by it. And they can feel like they're having an experience where they'll come up to you and share, wow, that was really, really great. I was not expecting to have that experience. And you feel like, wow, music took them there. And I helped take them there. You know, so like that type of exchange became very valuable to me. And I think, I just stuck with it. And I think it's a testament to my family and my friends that I was able to kind of stick with it because it's not really an easy path. I think a lot of jazz musicians and a lot of freelance artists can tell you it's very, very difficult. But I also feel like there was nothing else that kind of felt as right as pursuing that. So that's where we went.
So the tabla, how did you come to it? And I've done some reading and it's said to be a very difficult musical instrument to master. So speak a bit about how you came to the tabla and is it difficult to learn and to master?
Yeah, it is extremely difficult. After studying orchestral percussion and learning audition pieces, you know, for orchestra, like Porgy and Bess, the opening xylophone part for the Porgy and Bess, that's an audition piece for orchestras. There's also a lot of other pieces that are extremely challenging that you have to learn. in order to audition for orchestras. And I would say studying the tabla is really taking it to another level, because like a lot of Indian music, you know, it's like the goal is kind of unattainable, to the pursuit of the perfection on these instruments is a lifelong goal. And some would even say in a typical Hindu way that it takes many lifetimes. So I think that this instrument with the tabla, I knew it was very difficult. I knew it was very hard. I had heard about how hard it was, similar to you. And I also already had gotten my, you know, my degree in music. And so I had some understanding of how hard one has to work in order to get good at an instrument, but also how to analyze music and how to use my ear to kind of translate the music onto something on paper. So my first attempts with getting familiar with Indian music was based in just listening and trying to transcribe it in my own way, which was Western notation, really. And I found it to be really, it made things a lot harder. It helped me crystallize what I was hearing, you know, I was able to kind of see something on the paper. But when it came to actually understanding what was being done, I think I was using this notation in a way which was kind of getting in the way. And it was forcing this Western music to be the translation, you know, of Indian music, while and what is lost in that translation, right? So I decided I really shouldn't approach it in a way that I would with Western music, where it's a lot of it is on the paper and stuff. And Indian classical music is not like that. Indian classical music is an oral tradition, and there's the paper doesn't effectively capture what is being done, or even a composition that's shared between people. It's the paper falls short of what actually can be, what is to be learned or what is to be recreated. So I really decided that I was going to find a local teacher in Delhi, where my parents are from, and my relatives. And they found a local teacher who just taught young people how to play piano and guitar. And he also happened to teach tabla. And this guy came to the house, and he was like, "Is it true that you're like a professional musician?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a professional musician in the U.S. And, you know, I'm very curious about learning tabla." And so then he started showing it to me, and he realized how serious I was, I think, very quickly. And so then he broke it down and he said, "Look, I can sit with you here for 3 hours and show you a bunch of stuff, but then you're going to have to practice for another 3 or 4 hours after I leave. and you're going to have to do that every day this week that we're meeting." He came every day. You know, by the second or third day, my arm was in a lot of pain, and I was very worried that I'd kind of done some damage, but this guy was just like, "You know, you got to just play through it. You got to just play through it. Your new muscles are being worked." And I played through it, and it was awesome. And, you know, I felt like I was starting to understand more of how you make these sounds on the tabla. How do you think about the meter? How do you think about time? How do you think about the feel? All these things were very much grounded in the language of how it's spoken. How does the instrument itself, you know, how do you use your voice to reflect the sound of the instrument? So in the case of tabla, there's all these syllables that are used called tabla bowls. And for example, like dati dage tu na kina tirkada dati dage na tin dati dage na tin dati dage na da da dati dage na da da. So these kinds of rhythmic syllables are very, they're like, they ground the feel of the instrument and of the time and the way that the meters felt, you know, like with a lot of jazz stuff, everything is kind of grounded in a triplet, right? So all the way from early blues stuff, there's like a 6/8 or a 12/8 feel. And then as the tempos sped up through the traditions of jazz and big band and bebop and even to today, that underlying triplet feel and the accent of like the last beat of the triplet and the way that pushes the time and gives time a sense of propulsion, that is like one part of what tabla does with feel. Like the way that they translate the feel, it's like there's so many potentials of how you can play across the beat or what part of the beat are you accenting on. So, you know, it really, it's just a very, very different approach. And so a big part of the process for me was unlearning a lot of what I assumed was the way music was made. And I think a lot of it was informed by European classical music. But even when later my vision was formed by jazz music, then the third time around with learning Indian music, I had to unlearn some of the ways that I believed music was made, because I thought jazz music was sort of this end all be all. And a lot of the Indian classical musicians I meet who don't know about other styles, they think Indian classical music is the end all be all. So I think there's this tendency to sort of center yourself, center the thing that you're learning and you're inspired by, and think that is the thing. And with Indian music, it was the third time for me to kind of learn music from the ground up, and try and learn it on its own terms from people who actually practice it and perform it, and who, you know, it's informed their lives. And so across every one of those styles, I think it's always resonated for me to work with practitioners who really live and breathe the craft, you know? So with Indian classical music, I was able to sit with the great master Zakir Hussain for a couple of his week-long workshops, which he would do once a year. And I was actually able to sit with the great master Pandit Anindo Chatterjee for several years. And you know, several teachers who were local players, and not legends, not like famous players. And for me, I think that has always been very meaningful, to work with players who aren't stars, you know, to learn from musicians who aren't, who's maybe they're not like at this high level of appreciation, where maybe they feel like they're up on a platform all the time. I've connected much more with players who are of a similar age group, maybe, you know, just peers of mine, really, and an exchange of information and an exchange of inspiration has always felt much more powerful to me.
Any memorable, teachable moments from those sit-ins and those lessons with some of the greats and lesser known greats that you can share with our audience?
Wow, yeah. I mean, let's say like a pro and a con. So like, I loved how Zakir Hussain would, you know, he would really, he seemed to be very spontaneous, and he seemed to be very informed by what was happening around him, and it informed what he plays on his instrument. You know, he was definitely felt like he had such a presence in the moment that you kind of were excited to see what he was going to come up with. And maybe no one knew, right? Like, it was something that he even wasn't sure what was going to be the next step. And he would use great metaphoric language, you know, like you have to feel the space and then you have to fill the space. And I thought that was a really great way of describing music in general. It's not just a percussive way of thinking, but it's a musical way of thinking. And so I really liked the way that he would express those ideas. I found it to be very rich with like potential interpretations, you know, for different kinds of musicians. And then on the other side, I think a very big teachable moment that I've come to learn, just in all kinds of music, and in Indian music, it felt like particularly visible to me, was just a tendency in society to, I think, elevate really great musicians to the status of really great teachers. And I think that is, those are two very distinct skill sets. And I've come across so many amazing musicians who are frankly not very good teachers. And it's really hard, I think, to bring a great musician down from the like elevated status. But I also think sometimes we see a great musician and we elevate them and we think that they are accessing something that only they can access. And the way to learn about that is to essentially just do whatever they say. And Indian classical music really kind of embraces that. And I found it to be a very difficult thing for me to understand. And I found it to be sort of weighted down with a lot of cultural context, which in the end, I think it sometimes makes it very hard to get closer to the music. You end up sort of getting, I think that society and social dynamics and even social structures, hierarchies, those things can really affect the way that music is passed down from generation to generation and how young people learn music. So I've always been very hesitant to sort of be on board with what's called the Guru Shishya Parampara, which is an Indian classical term, which means the teacher-student bond, which is a very, very serious and meaningful thing. I mean, there's a time of a string, there's a ceremony. Some people would say it's like this teacher has become now part of your family. And for me, I think growing up with an immigrant parents who came from India, you know, my parents and my family have always been so tight knit. You know, it's like it's hard to just even act like this teacher is a member of your family. I don't want to put on pretenses, you know. And so I've always really kind of valued the ability to say, you're an amazing teacher. I really love learning from you, but I also want to keep this relationship very clear and transparent. And it is very different than the relationship someone would have with their parents, you know, and the other teachers that maybe they've had from their earliest lives.
I don't want to assume that all in the audience knows or is familiar with the tabla. So would you describe it so that those who may not be so inclined to be aware of it knows what it looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So the tabla is a North Indian classical percussion instrument. It's kind of the definitive North Indian classical percussion instrument. It's two drums that you play sitting down. There's a sort of smaller diameter drum and a larger diameter drum. And you play them with your fingers. It's not like a conga or a bongo as much. There's not a lot of like heavy palm playing, but more very intricate and delicate fingers are like flying around on this drum. There's a black dot in the middle of each of the drums, which really helps create this beautiful bell-like tone when it resonates. So the tabla is like what you would see accompanying artists like Ravi Shankar in classical settings, as well as Ustad Ali Akbar Khan, musicians like Hari Prasad Chaurasia. These are very, you know, Shiv Kumar Sharma. These are like the previous generations, like legends of Indian classical music. And Ravi Shankar himself is often attributed to kind of making a platform for the tabla. So in a sitar concert, which was Ravi Shankar's instrument, he would also create a space for the tabla to take a solo. And that was not always typical. You know, people weren't doing that very much. And that was also the time when Zakir Hussain was coming up. And so that was also part of the appeal, was this amazing young tabla player, give him a moment to really shine and to show the beauty of the instrument. And Zakir Hussain's father, Ustad Ala Rakha, was Ravi Shankar's like primary tabla player. And so Ravi Shankar's sort of created a platform for Ala Rakha and Zakir Hussain to both present a lot of solo tabla in front of what would otherwise be a sitar audience. The tabla has gone through an amazing evolution. You know, today, you hear the tabla in so many different settings and you would never know it, but in a place like the Bay Area, there's a lot of really great Indian classical musicians because the Ali Akbar College of Music, which is up in San Rafael, which has been here for decades, has really output many, many talented Indian classical musicians and even more lovers of Indian classical music. And so the Bay Area is a great place to see Indian music and to see the tabla be played in real life, you know? So you can find the tabla all around the US, I think, but in the Bay Area, you'll see it quite a bit.
As we run toward the end of our session here, talk a bit about couple of your selections and the impactfulness of those selections to you.
Song called Journey for Turiya Sangeeta Nanda. And that one is from my recent project called the Jupiter Project. And as some of you maybe know, Turiya Sangeeta Nanda was the name that Alice Coltrane was given by her guru and her spiritual teacher, Swami Sachidananda. So Alice Coltrane had done a record called Journey in Sachidananda. And she has been a huge inspiration for me in a way. You know, she went further than John Coltrane, I would say, in following the spirituality of Indian music. And I think I really appreciated how much she gave towards that. And I wanted to do a song in tribute to her. And so the Jupiter Project actually is a series of volumes that I've been releasing. And they're meant to reflect an idea of like what would be connected to the idea of an Akashic record. An Akashic record is what I started learning about as something that captures all of the sound and information in the ether. So even when a show or a song that we're playing as musicians isn't recorded, like the recording machine broke or someone forgot to hit record, or it was just a great show and no one brought a recorder. Someone shared with me once when we were lamenting that fact, someone said, "Oh, don't worry, it's in the Akashic record." And I thought that was such a great way to look at it. You know, it's always been there, the Akashic record. Akash means sky in Sanskrit. And so the Akashic record is sort of what's been captured by our surroundings and the air and the ether. And in a way, everything from the beginning has been captured by that record. And so in my journey, as I've lost family members and as friends and people, I reflected on how nice it would be to have an Akashic radio receiver. And I wanted to capture that intention by using Indian classical old recordings, the samples, and put them through some effects to create almost like an ethereal wash of what this raga or this Indian music, the impression that it gives, and then have some of my favorite Indian classical musicians improvise, or have jazz musicians, I should say, improvise on that Indian classical backdrop. And a lot of the musicians I work with speak both languages. And so this track, Journey for Turiya Sangeetha Nanda, is an improvisation that we did on a raga called Koshi Kannada. And I pretty much gave the musicians a baseline which captured this raga and asked them to improvise in a long meditative fashion, which is also very reminiscent of how Indian classical music is played. And then, you know, using synthesizers, keyboards, analog keyboards, electric bass, woodwinds, myself on drum set and tabla, we try and reflect that journey. And and I think that part of the goal is to create an image which is maybe like a reflection of songs and sounds that have come from the past, and maybe have us be able to have a sense of communion with those sounds, and maybe kind of reflect some messages that we can get from those sounds.
Shamir Gupta was my guest. Here's an excerpt from Gupta's work entitled The Jupiter Project. If you ever find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.